Yeah, here we are. Rocked Recovery Radio episode, fill in the blank. I say that every week. You think one day I'll figure it out. Rocked Recovery Radio, I'm your host, Wes Geer, here on KX93.5.com. We're back at it, doing it again. Also, thank you for the support from New Vista Behavioral Health. There's that other light I need. Ernesto, I got to keep you out of my light. Yeah, see, now I look all sinister. There you go. Way better. Thank you. New Vista Behavioral Health is a partner bringing this to you with the amazing station, which is KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM. And like I said, I'm your host, or maybe I didn't, Wes Geer. And why are we here? I'm a sober dude. I'm passionate about recovery. And I've been saying that every week and on the... You're looking good over there, guest. I haven't announced it yet, so I can't say your name. I've been saying this every week. Why are we here? You know, I'm passionate about recovery, but what does that mean, passionate about recovery? It means I'm sick of watching my friends and people I know die. I mean, it's just a bum out. And we don't have to be all Debbie Downer about it, but it's a serious thing we're battling here. So what's Rocked Recovery Radio about? We like to talk about addiction, mental health, you know, PTSD, TBI, whatever, eating disorders, whatever these ailments are, these disorders, these diseases that take our friends and our family members out, our loved ones, and we lose them in droves. And so in talking about it, we can share information, we can share inspiration, we can destigmatize it, we can make it a more comfortable arena for other people, hopefully, to find support, love, and communication in there. So this week, we have a guest I was looking forward to. We've known each other a little while. We got some of the same friends. And she just finally had her book come out called I Married a Junkie, Put to the Ultimate Test by Addiction, Love, and Life. Welcome. And she's also sober how long?
Since I was 23, so long time. Long time.
Yeah. Want to give us how many years?
Oh, my God. I'll be 44 in July. So that's a lot.
Okay. Well, so my math says 21 years.
Yeah.
Sobes. 21 years sobes. That's a long time. So welcome to Rock to Recovery, Dr., PhD doctor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Callie Estes.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah.
On my standing ovation.
Hear that? We're high tech now. We've added the crowd noise to our radio show.
I like it.
Yeah. So thanks for coming down. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Or up, or whatever direction it was for you.
Down.
Down.
I think. South.
Down. Well, you were in L.A.
Yeah, I flew in for this.
Yeah.
Special.
Dang.
Yeah.
Rock to Recovery Radio has people flying in.
Flew in from Miami this morning just to be here
with
you guys.
You're a jet setter. You are. Well, thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, stoked that you're here. So let's get right to it. You know, we talk to people about their struggles and whatever it was and how they got through it,
mm-hmm.
and the key moments in that journey and how amazing their life is now. You know, not just like, hey, I survived being a junkie and yay for me, but hey, being in the vortex of radness, you're an author, you're a PhD. So for you... where do you start your story? Because I think it's different for everybody. Some people are like, you know, I was five and I wanted to, you know, bite my dog's ear off or something. Who knows, right? It's different for everybody. Other people are like, you know what? My childhood was cool, but I toured or whatever and then I drank too much. For you, where would you start?
I'll get right into it for you. My dad put a gun to my head and used to play Russian roulette.
At how old?
Five. Started at five. So I have a bipolar father. So we'll just jump right in there.
Jiminy Christmas.
So that led me to what's wrong with me.
I did not know that about you.
Yeah, that's in my book.
Yeah, well.
So it gave you a little nugget.
Oh, man. Okay.
So that started my thing. And my mother was a
What'd you say, 5 years old?
Five.
Five?
Yeah.
I mean, now, most people don't remember much before five. How much did that... You know, did that feel real? Like, do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Were you scared for your life? Like
no,
this?
Because at five, you think you're invincible. So he would put me on a bar stool, And I could tell you the color of the wall, the color of the stool, the smell of the room, the smell of the carpet. That's how vivid it is. And he would say, okay, we're going to put a 22, put the bullet in and push it.
He literally did it.
Yeah. And he would say, I'm going to teach you a trick. Because the bullet's heavy, it'll go to the bottom. So it'll never kill you. And then he would pull the trigger. And he'd go, see? So it was more like a game. And then it became, okay, so this is what we do. And then I learned this is not what we do. This is not normal. So as I started to learn this is not normal, I said, something's really wrong. But at the same time, my mother had an eating disorder. So we grew up in a dry household. So there wasn't alcohol and there wasn't drugs, but she would eat, eat, eat. So I learned the eat, eat, eat concept. So this is what you do when you're stressed, you eat.
Right.
So that's what I did. And then when I got into my 20s, I ended up going to the psychologist in college because my roommate said, there's something wrong with you. You know, people don't do this. She'd come home at night, and I'd be, you know, eating a whole cake. I'd bake a cake. There's cake on the floor, cake on the wall, cake on the dog, cake on me. And she's like, there's something wrong with you. Like, that's not normal.
Yeah.
But to me, it's like, that's normal.
Well, right. And this is something that I, in my book, it's going to be a chapter. But it's called Your Normal. Not you are, but Your Normal. Because we go through that, right? When we're growing up, whatever life we're given is normal to us. And there's can be some bizarre stuff going on that we think's okay, and we may not find out till decades later. Like, oh.
I was 21 when someone said, hey, this isn't how we cope with stress.
Right.
And I ended up going to the counselor who at that time in the DSM-5 said, well, you don't throw up, so you're not bulimic. And you don't restrict, so you're not anorexic. So there's really nothing wrong with you.
Oh.
And I'm like, well, yeah, but I stuffed my face for 2 days and I don't eat for 2 days. Like, there's something wrong with me. So she sent me to the fat doctor.
So for people that don't know, the DSM-5 is a medical book of diagnoses.
So people, you come in to the psychiatrist, psychologist, and they'll say, this is what's wrong with you, technically. And then this is how we treat it. But because I didn't fit the book, they didn't know what to do with me. So they sent me to the fat doctor. And the
you were binging, but you weren't purging.
Exactly. It would involuntarily throw up because I had too much food. So because that's not in the book, there's nothing wrong with
silly.
You. So I ended up at the fat doctor who put me on Fen-Phen. Well, Fen-Phen led to Ephedra, which is basically meth.
I did Ephedra too, but for different reasons.
Yeah, I loved Ephedra. And that led to speed. So speed was my main drug of choice.
Because
now I can eat anything I want, and I'm 90 pounds. So I had the best of both worlds. Now I'm thin and pretty, and I can still eat anything I want.
I think a lot. I know a lot of girls that have that story. For many, especially that have addiction issues, eating disorders go hand in hand. But I know I've known a lot of girls who enjoyed the binging and then the mething, the methamphetamine. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's a sick little ritual.
Yeah.
And it's a ritual. Like, we'll set it up. We'll go to the grocery store, and we know we'll buy exactly what we want. It's sick in itself.
Kind of like, and the thing that I love to point out here, because we're trying to, you know, bring light to all the stuff, is it's so much the same as with being a junkie. You know, you have the ritual of the dope and how you're going to rig it up or whatever, or how you smoke your, man, at tweakers, I'm telling you, they get all into, this is how you smoke it. No, dude, you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
Same thing. It's ritualistic. And what a lot of people don't know, for example, I sponsored a guy who definitely was a drug addict, but he couldn't stay sober, and he never let up that he had an eating disorder as well, being a dude. And so they went hand in hand. Until he addressed that, he couldn't have success. They're very similar, you know?
I think a lot of people that have eating disorders get left behind because we say, well, it's just food. You know, you're not really a junkie because you're eating food. But in the long run, if you're eating the way I was eating and you're eating the amounts of food and you're doing that consistently to your body, you're destroying your body.
Well, people die from eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to, So I want to back up to the gun thing. That's insane. Do you think, I mean, where was your mom in this?
My mother was your typical, she told me not to talk about her, but I'm going to do it anyway. She was your typical blinders on, like, this isn't happening, this can't be happening. So, and it was horrifying for her because she's Catholic.
Yeah.
So she went to the priest and said, this is happening. Of course, the priest said, you don't get divorced in the Catholic Church. So she's like, what do I do? Well, he's your husband, you have to handle it.
Love and honor him.
Right. And my father was sick. You know, he's extremely bipolar, extremely manic. When he's medicated, he's great. When he's off his meds, he's extremely manic. So back then, I mean, you're talking late 80s, early 90s, nobody knew what to do with this scenario. Right. So it was just kind of, went. And then eventually the whole thing came to a head. I was 13 and I said to my mom, if you don't divorce him, I'm going to shoot him. Like, we're there. We're at that point.
That was 13?
Yeah. Wow. And then she took me to a counselor.
Right, took you to a counselor. Mm-hmm. Right.
And I can't say what happened on it. Well, the counselor asked me to color my feelings, and I was 13, and I promptly ripped up the coloring book and used a few very strong choice words at 13 and got deposited in the waiting room. And it was a thank you, but we can't work with her.
Which is, it's just crazy, because mm-hmm. you weren't in the wrong there. You were showing, like, you were so emotional about mm-hmm. it that you're like, I'm getting the vibe. It was like, F you, I'm coloring.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, and you're 13, so you have a brain at this point. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, she's just a little too irate. Maybe because what you were going through. But this is thank God we're where we're at now, because we talk about this stuff so openly. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was nobody, like you said, nobody knew what to do with it. Everybody just stuffs it down. And families, wow, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And with my grandmother was the kind where it's not happening. Nothing right. is wrong. Our family's absolutely perfect. Nobody knows. We have family dinner. We have Thanksgiving. We have Christmas. No one knows what's going on. And it was like all this craziness has happened.
I think that's just how families used to be, right? Because mm-hmm. you had men were infidels. With, mm-hmm. you know, it was just normal mm-hmm. to have mistresses back in the day in the 50s or whatever. It just seems like families were like that.
I didn't
just
know.
Just shove it all down. Pretend everything's okay.
10 years ago, I found out my uncle was an alcoholic. I had no idea. It's like that kind of stuff. Like, because I'm thinking to myself, there has to be an addiction component in my family.
It's genetic,
and, yeah. And I would ask, and no one was an addict. You know, you're the first one. I'm like, this is not right. Something's wrong. And then finally, I found out my uncle was an alcoholic, and it was like, wow, there we go.
Makes sense. Yeah, for people that don't know at home, it is passed genetically, mm-hmm. and they say strongest on the father's side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, wow, yeah, heavy stuff. I can relate, too. I'm not saying that my family did that, because you know how you're saying your mom listens. But I can relate to some of that stuff. You know, okay, so tell me, so you're having the eating issues, mm-hmm. and you're, what, in college now?
Mm-hmm.
And so did you take a break or just go straight in, and so you're battling all these demons while becoming a PhD?
Well, I took a break. So I did my bachelor's, then I took a break and did my master's, and then I took about a 10-year hiatus because then I was working. I was already in the industry, and then I went back and got my PhD. Mm. So I just got my PhD 2 summers ago. So,
but in your 20s, when you were talking about the eating issues, you knew you had some problems.
I knew, yeah, and I didn't realize I was an addict. Because I didn't identify. I'm like, well, I don't snort coke. I drink like a college kid, but that wasn't my thing.
Like a college kid.
I'm not doing heroin. I'm not doing opiates. I don't like them. So I'm not an addict. And then I did my internship at the prison at SCI Rockview at Penn State. And I wanted to work with the crazy guys, the sex offenders. And they said, you're going to work with the addicts. And I'm like, okay, boring.
Yeah.
And my mentor said it's not boring. And after about a week, I was like, identify with these people. I get these people. And he goes, oh, do you? And then he sat down and he kind of mentored me. He's like, you're an addict. You know that. And I was like, no, I'm not. He goes, yeah, you are.
Wow.
And then he kind of talked to me about it because he was a therapist. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of where I got like not only hands-on training, but it was like that aha moment where you're like, wow, I get it.
Well, and so were you saying you're like an addict because of the manifestations of the eating disorder, or how was your use at that time?
It was bad. It was pretty bad.
So it's worse than you let on.
Yeah.
Because what you said a second ago was like, yeah, it's not bad. And that's what we do, right? It's not that bad.
I was 90 pounds and 5'2", and I should sit around 125.
So you had co-occurring. You had eating and...
Right. And I would sit, and I would, because I had so much speed in my system, I would just shake, you know, and people are like, what are you taking? Nothing. What's wrong with you? Nothing. You know, and you're like, they know, and you know they know, but you're like, I'm not going to get involved, so I'm just going to say nothing. And then eventually they give up and say, okay. And they leave you alone.
So that's when you're on the ephedra.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how long before you switch to the street version?
Fast. I like the Rip Fuel. So I did ephedra, maha, wang, guarana, stack. That was my favorite.
I don't even know what you just said. It sounded like...
Ephedra? The maha wang is like an asthma pump.
Maha wang. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And guarana is pure caffeine.
Oh, guarana.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I would do the stack. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to take one capsule twice a day, and I would take three times a day. So I was already there. And then I started doing speed on top of it. And it was
How
like
old were you then?
21.
And right. And so are you out of college at this time?
No.
Is this when the break started?
Mm-mm.
Oh, gosh.
No, I ended up, I had just finished college and I was getting heart palpitations.
Mm.
And my roommate said to me, she's like, you know, you probably should go to the doctor. And I went to the doctor and he said, what are you taking? And of course, nothing, you know. And he says, well, I know you're on something. Oh, no, nothing. And he said, listen, if you're taking any kind of uppers, you're going to have problems. Oh, no, I'm fine, I'm fine. I ended up in the ER. And it was like a six-month window later, and the doctor, he was very, very good. He sat me down, and he said, you've already have a heart murmur. You're blowing a hole in your heart. You're going to die.
Ugh.
And it was like, no, I'm not. He goes, you're not listening. You're going to die. He goes, you've got to stop. And he knew right away. He's like, I know what you're doing. And he just looked at me, and I was like, seriously. He goes, now. Not tomorrow, not next week, now. And I was like, okay. I'm going to detox.
Don't tell me what happened. I want to hold it right there. This is great. I appreciate you sharing, by the way. Let's throw in the song now. I think this is a good time.
Okay.
What's your first song?
Night Train.
Night Train, yeah.
Night Train.
Why'd you pick that one?
I could work out to it. And I would get so hepped up on speed. You know how the high tempo.
Yeah.
And I could just go in the gym and I would just bang the weights out and I was full of energy. It was awesome.
So you're working out.
Oh, yeah.
Like any good tweaker.
Of course.
Yeah.
2 hours a day, every day.
So here we are, Rock to Recovery. See, we laugh because I get it. That's why. If there's people out there listening and they haven't had this life, they're like, these sick people laughing at it. It's a weird thing we do. Anyhow, here we are on Rock to Recovery Radio with Dr. Callie Estes. I'm your host, Wes Gear. And here's Night Train, Guns N' Roses. Imagine this is Callie on the treadmill, all tweaked out.
My arms, and I'm a beast.
Listen to Slash just shredding over there. This is Wes Geer, Rock to Recovery Radio. We're back, KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM, also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. I'm sitting here. I'm so proud of myself that I did the bump back in because I always forget to do that. I'm sitting here with, you know, it's the showbiz talk. I'm sitting here with Dr. Callie Estes. She's sharing her story. Incredible story for those of you just tuning in. Her bipolar dad
yeah.
was playing Russian roulette with a .22 to her head at 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Mom had a eating disorder that you mm-hmm. caught from her. You caught anyhow.
Learned behavior.
Yeah. And then you got into ephedra, which turned into that combo thing with the guarna and I don't know. It sounded like you're speaking Russian to me, but I know what you're saying. But then you were into street drugs, and you went to see a cardiologist?
First one, yeah, it was a cardiologist. Yeah. The second one was an ER doctor.
ER doctor, and he said, you're going to die if you don't stop tweaking. You have a murmur.
Yes, he showed me on the EKG, like the murmur.
Yeah.
And he said, this is, you know, yours, and this is normal. Mm. And you're, like, at a 6 out of 10.
And how did you feel? Because we feel
defeated.
Kind of invincible when we're druggies.
Defeated, frustrated, because the doctor put me on, you know, Fen-Phen.
Yeah.
Started the whole thing. And I'm you know, it's legal. Of course, it went down the non-legal way. But
right.
I was like, well, I got here because a doctor put
me on. A prescription drug. Which,
and
how many people in America can say that these days?
A lot.
I mean, come on.
And his thing was, well, it doesn't matter. You're at the point now where you have to stop. You can't do this anymore.
This is like a crucial little interjection that I love to make. I have so many friends that know they got to stop getting loaded that have come into various support programs, 12-step programs, but they're like, I got to be on this. I need Xanax and I need, you know, this and I need, you know, whatever, Adderall because I can't focus. It's like, well, you can't focus because you've been slamming dope for years. Mm. So you're going to have to go. But how do you get sober if you're and you know, how do you tell somebody they don't need it? Because some people do need it.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to rehab, they wanted to put me on stuff. They said, you have ADD. I'm like, look, I didn't get off speed to get on Adderall. I'll rough it out for a month, and if it sucks, I'll come see you. Mm-hmm. I'm not a doctor. Some people need it, so yeah. I guess my point is, man, pharmaceuticals are just a dangerous trap.
Yeah, and they hand them out like candy.
And then I hit up a doctor one time, actually a friend of the family. My dad was a MD as well, but he passed away years ago. But it was a friend of the family, and I came at him kind of aggressively, like, you doctors, you don't prescribe meditation. You don't prescribe any of this other, you know, holistic, whatever, homeopathic stuff. And he said, I hear you, but how about this? Most people that come in that say I'm having anxiety, if I say you should meditate more, they tell me, screw you, give me some Xanax, doc. Mm-hmm. And I was like, touche. Fair enough. So then my response to that is like, nobody has ads and markets drugs like America. No other country does.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's true.
If you blink too much, take a drug. Do you have too many nose hairs? We got a drug. You ever have your lip quiver? Take a drug. You use too much toilet paper? We got a drug for that. I mean, there's a drug for everything. You know?
Yeah.
Anyhow. I just went off on a tangent. So you're about to die. What do you do?
So I went back to the counselor and I said, I need help. Obviously, this is a problem. And she gave me a pamphlet for NA and a pamphlet for OA. So I went to OA first, Overeaters Anonymous, and there's, you know, no food, no drinks, so nothing. Okay. Then I went to NA and they had sugar, which is my drug of choice, caffeine, which is my drug of choice, and they're smoking. And I'm like, that's also my drug of choice.
Wow.
So there I am going, I don't know if I can do this because it doesn't make sense to me. So I was talking to a friend of mine one night and I said, you know, I was just bawling my eyes out because I said, I don't know what to do. Like, I can't figure this out. I don't have health insurance. So there's no, you know, nowhere to go. No one's going to take you for detox for speed. And I don't qualify for eating disorder because I don't fit the DSM. So she goes, come to yoga with me. I'm like, okay, yoga. What is that going to do? She goes, just be quiet and go. So I went to yoga and there I am complaining the entire time. You know, I can't touch my toes. This is too hard. This is too hot. And she looks at me and she says, shut up.
I mean, just you love working out.
Yeah, but not yoga. So she goes, just be quiet. So I did the class and afterward the teacher came over and he was in recovery and he went to AA. And he's
Does
like,
she know that or is that
she
just,
did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's in recovery too. So I didn't know any of this.
Okay.
So
she's doing the sneak attack.
Yeah.
Cool.
So he came over and he's like, listen, just keep coming to yoga. It'll get better. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So I went back to the next class and then he started teaching me meditation. And he said, instead of reaching for the fridge, I want you to do 10 sun salutations. Mm. Of course, I'm like, right. Okay, that's stupid. He goes, just try it. Okay.
Right.
So I did it and I went, wow, this worked. I didn't have the desire to eat. I didn't have the desire to reach for anything. I was like, I feel better.
Just one time?
Well, I repeated.
Okay,
I was to do it until the feeling went. He said 20 minutes, which he knew, you know, the 20-minute rule. So it took me 20 minutes to do sun salutations.
Yeah.
So I kept going back, and he said, you're not balanced. You're not centered. He goes, like, you're all over the place. You don't even know who you are. And then when he said that, it clicked, and I was like, wow, I don't. And he goes, work with me. And he's a meditation teacher. Mm. So he started doing all this meditation with me and a little bit of Buddhism and Taoism.
Taoism.
And he started teaching me all this stuff, and some of it resonated, some of it didn't. And I ended up going to Sweat Lodge with the Lakotas, the Lakota tribe. And I finally felt...
Where's this?
New York.
New York, okay.
I went to this group called Women Gathering, which was borderline gay pride festival.
Okay.
But they had the sweat lodges, and they had all these different things there. And I went, and I felt connected for the first time in my life. Like, I felt rooted.
Spiritually?
Very.
Okay.
Because I came from a very Catholic family, and I didn't fit in. I went to the Catholic church.
Shame, guilt.
Yep. And none of it made any sense.
Yeah.
So here's my dad who's cheating on my mom with her best friend.
Well, you left that part out.
Yeah.
With the best friend, even.
Yeah.
I mean,
My dad's been married four times. He's on the fifth one.
Well, he has some mental health issues, so we'll give him that.
So for me, Catholic didn't work, and I couldn't find anything. So when I did that, and I put the yoga and the meditation and the sweat lodge together, it clicked. And that's when I got straight. But up to that point, nothing was working. I mean, it was like I was just lost and I couldn't figure it out. And I reached for anything that would make me feel better. And then once I realized I didn't need to reach for that stuff, it was inside me. That's when it like shifted.
I love that you share that. Yeah. It's an inside job.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same for anybody. I still do it now. You know, having a bummer day, I think I need a new pair of shoes or I need to get on Bumble or whatever. Looking on the outside, right? Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, that's cool.
I shared this with you the first time we met. I have a spot in Laguna Beach. I travel all around
the
world.
Oh, yeah.
So I went down to my spot. I'm freezing cold because I'm wearing shorts at night. Mm. And I'm laying in my spot just to get centered and balanced before I leave.
That is cool. I vaguely remember there was something magic that happened in that spot. Mm-hmm. It was a meditation.
Every time I'm there, you can feel like the energy coming up. And I get completely centered and bad. It's like a clean slate. It's weird. Mm. And then anything I ask for, or any intention I put out, comes back.
What if I sit there?
Go sit there, see if it works.
You'll share?
That's my spot.
I know.
We'll see.
Maybe I should just let it be your spot.
You could try it.
All right. Will you give me a map?
Sure.
It's like a treasure
map.
You know
where the two Starbucks are? It's in the middle.
Oh, that's where my house is, right there.
It's
You're
on
saying
the grass.
Main Beach, Laguna Main
yeah.
Beach. Oh, the grass, where the
grass.
Bums hang out.
Well, in between the bums.
And the pigeons.
In the middle of the pigeons, yeah.
Yeah.
They usually come
flock
around.
Oh, interesting. So was it truly the doctor's forebodings that got you to start changing your life?
It was the fear of death, I think.
Yeah.
Being so young, going, how did I get here?
Mm-hmm.
And what do I do? And then reaching out to help. And counselors telling me there's nothing wrong with you because you don't meet criteria.
Ugh, that's so silly.
And doctors telling me, well, you need a fat pill, fat burner, but we can't give you that because you have a heart condition from the fat burner. So no one could give me any answers.
Right. But you know, because that's great for you. And there are some people who that's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There's some literature that I read that says, yeah, there's some people who are addicted or whatever, and if their life is in danger, they can do a turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
For a guy like me, I don't know if that would be enough. I don't know. Thank God I didn't have to find out up to this point. So what I'm curious about, that's how you hit your bottom pretty much, you know, that's how you found your way out. You're combining these, you know, spiritual practices, not attached to any religion. That's cool. I love how you said it. They worked all together. They came together in like a synergistic alchemy, if you will. But what about dealing with past trauma?
That's a whole nother ball game.
Did you just stay sober from that point on?
No. I was very angry. So I was your typical dry drunk. I was mad.
That's what I want to hear about. Yeah, I was bad.
And I ended up in a class in my master's program, and they asked for a volunteer. And mm-hmm. me being me, I'm like, okay, whatever. So I volunteered, and it was for psychodrama. Mm, and I had done it to that point. So I got put in the hot seat for psychodrama, and it was intense. And it really brought me there. And afterwards, I said to the instructor, I think I...
Brought you where?
To being 5 years old, sitting on a chair. It brings you there. And I said, I think I need to work with somebody. So he gave me the name and number of somebody who does psychodrama, and I started working with them. And it was intense. I mean, those sessions, like, you're there for 2 hours, you leave, you're wiped.
Were you cool with doing that? Because some people, I have friends that they know they should do it, and they're like, no, I don't want to feel that, no. And they'll run.
It was horrible, but the best thing I did.
Right.
Because I had to process that.
You got to feel to heal. And there's endless stories of people. That's why I thought it was interesting you stayed sober with those holistic spiritual approaches. Because some people can't. I just met a guy down in San Diego. He actually owns a treatment center. But he was like, I did so many rehabs. And until I sat down with somebody and I dealt with the trauma I had gone through, I couldn't stay sober. And I like what you said, too, is that you were sober, but you're dry.
Yeah.
And for those that don't know what that's like, it basically means you're in hell. You're just not happy. You're not serene. You're angry. You're mm-hmm. grumpy. You maybe don't even know why. And you're like, I can't pick up and get loaded because we know what that's about. And a lot of people get suicidal in that spot because they're like, I can't get loaded. And if this is all life's about, you know what I mean? So they either get loaded again or they self-harm or mm-hmm. or even commit suicide. Yeah. So.
Well, my thing that brought me out was... My father always said I was stupid, fat, and ugly.
Ugh.
So I said, I'm going to prove you wrong. I took that and I said, watch what I do.
Yeah.
I'm going to build an empire. Screw you. That's what pulled me out. My will to fight. My sister went the other direction.
You're so awesome.
I'm the fighter.
She just went,
whatever. So that's what I did. And I said, I'm going to show you. And then I spent 5 years showing him. And then when I realized... wasn't about him, was about me.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, I'm doing this for all the wrong reasons. Mm. And then it all clicked.
Another click.
Yeah,
a few clicks. That's amazing.
It's time though. It's not like people talk about people talk about, you know, I had this epiphany. It's not one epiphany. It's multiple epiphanies over multiple years and you
recovery.
Add. Yeah. And you add and you add and you add and then it's like it all gels.
Yeah,
and you just keep adding. It's not like you wake up tomorrow and go, "Ooh, I'm gonna be sober. Life's awesome." No, you wake up and you're like, "Ooh, I'm sober. Life sucks."
Yeah.
And then what do I do? Oh, okay. I put my first foot forward, and I keep putting my feet forward, and then I add this, and then I add that, and then bam, you're like, "Wow, I love life. It's amazing."
Yeah, I agree. They call it like the layers of the onion,
mm-hmm.
you know. But a lot of people they want to run before they get too deep into that feeling and healing part, right?
Yeah.
For me. I have 10 and a half years. I continue to have epiphanies. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I'm no spring chicken. And then I'm meditating and this light bulb goes off. Ding. Wow. I'm glad I just figured that out 10 and a half years later into my 40s and all that. It's like, that's how it goes. Right.
Yeah.
But isn't that the beauty of it? That we get that in life. You could say, like, this sucks, I'm a sober person, or I had this bad family, or eating disorder, whatever. We could get really mm-hmm. into self-pity. But what we get when we're in recovery is this other life where we're either going to grow or be in hell mm-hmm. and go back to what we were, or worse. And when we're constantly growing, not that we're better than other people, but you start seeing some of your friends who are still how you were in your 20s, and they're still that way. I just went through this with this guy. He started pulling stuff he pulled when we get in fights when we were 20. I was like, dude, aren't we a little old for this? Like, just throwing daggers. Like, what? And he started going, wow, I've evolved now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're out there struggling and you're hearing all this, there's a beauty of getting into recovery is continuing to, you know, work on the character defects and the things that take you out.
Mm-hmm.
And make life miserable, huh?
Oh, absolutely. And it's also realizing where your limits are. Because I'll, you know, be talking to somebody and they'll remind me of my father and I'll be instantly triggered. And it's like, whoa, you know, that's not them. That's me.
But you're aware of it.
I'm aware of it. And I can say, okay, let's not let that take over because you can see it.
Yeah.
Back, you know, back in your 20s and your early 30s, you don't see it. You get triggered and you're like, oh, that stupid person, that person, this, that person. No, it's you. It's not them.
Great point. Yeah.
So it's new and it's like being able to say, I get it. It's me. And then going, I got to diffuse that. And
right.
How do I get rid of that? And for me, it's yoga.
Yeah. So this is a great thing to talk about because we all have damage that happened in our childhood. Doesn't mean that you had to be molested or beaten. It could be anything. You know, your dog dying. It could be anything. We can have trauma, whether it was from a normal life experience or not. And it shapes how we react to life, like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And until we deal with that, if you're listening at home, it really makes our life smaller, right? It holds us back in so many areas, and we're not even aware of it. I love that you brought up the fact until we deal with it and maybe mm-hmm. do some trauma talk and understand, oh, that's a trigger. That's why this bothers me. Think how many people out there that just get pissed at something. It's a good challenge to play, especially if you're in recovery. I love it when it says when they're disturbed, it's something in us.
Mm-hmm. Every
right?
time.
Every time. It's like, what? No, it's not. It's because they did. It's like, no, because we should be able to flow through life and go, hey, that doesn't bother me. I'm cool. Whatever. That's on you. Yeah, it's great stuff. Well, let's throw in a song. Do you know what your second song is?
Probably Nikki Six.
Man, 6 a.m.? I saw there's
yeah.
2 6 a.m.s on there.
I'm a Nikki Six fan.
Yeah, that's cool.
I have his bass guitar.
Oh, that's cool.
Signed, yeah.
That's cool. You know, the second tour I ever did was with Motley Crue, and I was tweaking still. What a bummer.
Oh, my God. You remember him?
I do. Yeah, yeah. There's some good stories there. But I remember Donna Dierico would be in his... He had a little tent, a little, like, hair makeup tent off the side of the stage. And I was like, man, Donna's pretty hot. Anyhow, Pamela Anderson would sit on stage with us. So I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
I wish I wasn't so tweaked out. I might have been a little more present. There's actually this one picture of us talking to Tommy Lee. My whole band is not tweaked out and the roadies. And everybody's laughing. And I'm like... got the serious face, twisting my goatee because I'm like, anyhow, if you can see at home, I was making like a monkey face. Anyhow, here we are, Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer, on KX935.com, sitting here having a rad talk with Dr. Callie Estes. What song are we doing?
Life is Beautiful.
Life is Beautiful, says Ernesto. This is 6 a.m. We'll be right back.
no one will cry at my funeral. Just open your eyes, just open your eyes and see that life is beautiful. Will you swear on your life that no one will cry at my funeral?
Dang. Nikki and Company in 6 a.m. I'm chewing a mint. I just got it all over the microphone. Throwing down. That sounded tight. Here we are. Rock and Recovery Radio. We're back. KX93.5 FM. Laguna's only FM and human crafted radio. I'm your host, Wes Gear. Being unprofessional. Eating mints on the air. Yeah, I know. Don't do that again on a break. I mean, let's be honest. I went down this restaurant that I like, and I had it was a lot of onions. I'm doing this for you.
Oh.
For you. I'm here with Dr. Callie Estes, telling her incredible story of a father that had mental health and played Russian roulette with a loaded gun when she was 5. Mom and her had eating disorder, got hopped up on goofballs, prescribed medication, and then got into tweaking, almost died. You're near death. And you got into yoga, sweat lodges. There was something else, too.
Meditation.
Oh, that's my favorite stuff. Meditation. And that helped you. And then you're dry and grumpy.
Of course I was dry.
Yeah. And then you did. She rolls her eyes. And then you did some trauma work, some psychodrama.
I did some psychodrama, yeah.
Yeah. How long did you do that for?
About a year? It was rough.
Yeah, so was that it? It was the you know, meditation and stuff, and then the psychodrama. Did you have any other program that you did?
I worked with a counselor too, like a therapist, in letting the anger go, because I was very angry.
Were you beating on cubes?
No, I mean, well, I have a djembe, so I would take it out there, you know,
a little music therapy. Fun,
yeah.
But we like that.
I was very road ragey. So I would, like, get behind the wheel of a car, and I was speeding and flipping people off. And, of course, my therapist is like, you shouldn't do that. You know, and I'm like, the therapist is not good. I need a strong therapist. She's like, really? That's not appropriate. I'm like, I need a stronger therapist. And I got another therapist who was very up my alley. He was very F this, F that, you know. And he was like,
really?
Oh, he was really good.
I can't imagine that.
I was incorrigible. I mean, when I say incorrigible, I was incorrigible. Like, I was... You know, this is my way or the highway, and I don't care what anybody thinks. And I was just there. And he says, why? You know, I was just mad. You know, I didn't have a childhood. I didn't have a father. I didn't have anything. And everybody had, you know, mom and dad put so-and-so through college and gave you a car. I had none of that. I literally left home with the clothes on my back.
You felt screwed over by life.
Oh, the world hated, you know. So I was mad. And he sat me down, and he got me through all of that. And one of the tools he gave me, he gave me a pen and paper, and he said, write a letter to your father.
Ooh, yeah.
And I'm like, why? He goes, just do it. I don't want to do it. Cross my arms. I'm not going to do it. And he's like, oh, incorrigible. Do it. Like,
how old were you at that point?
I was probably 24, 25.
That was a very, like, six-year-old girl maneuver.
I'm not doing it. He's like, you're going to do it, and you're going to like it. I'm like, okay, fine. I'll do it, but I won't like it.
Right.
He would roll his eyes at me and go, really? Really?
Mm-hmm.
And he'd look at me. Really?
Yeah.
And I'd go, yeah. And he'd go, okay, fine. So I did the letter, and it came back. And, of course, I did it, you know, 5 minutes before I was supposed to be there. And I wrote one paragraph, and he goes, not acceptable. Do it again. I'm like, okay, whatever. He goes, just go home and do the letter.
It's your recovery, girl.
But I was going to show him, you know?
Yeah.
So I did the letter, and I came back, and I had, like, 15 pages. And he goes, how do you feel? And
so we went from a paragraph to 15 pages on a letter.
On a letter. And I was still mad. I was madder. And he goes, okay, do it again. I'm like, do it again. I just did it. He goes, do it again. I did it again. I came back. He's like, how do you feel? I said, I'm even more mad. He goes, start your letter off with, dear dad, I hate you. And I'm like, okay, I can do that. Now I'm in.
Oh, yeah, you bought it.
And the whole letter, I filled up an entire legal pad.
Oh, my gosh.
Of stuff. And I came back, and he said, how do you feel? And I said, better. Like, it's out, you know?
Yeah.
And he goes, don't send it to your father. Of course, I sent it to my father.
Oh, my gosh.
I wanted to show him. I was that mad.
Oh, my gosh.
So he says, now you realize.
I mean, you can't fit that much in a normal size envelope.
Oh, I sent it, put it right in there and sent it 2-day air.
Oh, my
gosh. Postal return. My father kept the letter. He kept it in a glass case. Because his daughter wrote him a letter. That's how sick his father was.
Okay. I was going to say, it's kind of delusional.
It's very sick. That's when the therapist said to me, you need to cut ties. This is where it started. Because I was trying so hard to have a relationship with him. And I would do anything to get that relationship. Scream, yell, carry on, take him to lunch, be nice. Nothing worked. So the therapist finally said to me, you need to cut ties. Yeah. You're never going to have that relationship. It's not possible.
Yep.
So when I did that, that's when it shifted. The next shift. Hmm. It was like being free.
When
it's like
you
cutting
let go.
A cord. Yeah.
They say, what I say in Buddhism, suffering is the attachment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's tough. Some of us, the families, they're never going to be good. Sometimes getting sober and doing the work helps repair. But sometimes they're just always going to be sick, and we have to – that's when compartmentalizing them can be healthy, right?
Well, yeah, and then I spent time, in my own head going, well, how is this fair? I don't get a dad.
Right.
Everybody else has a dad. But me. And my stepdad had died at that point. So he had died of diabetes. So I'm like, well, not even my stepdad died. No one loves me. You get the whole victim. I'm a victim.
Yeah.
So my therapist worked me through that, too. He's like, you're not a victim. You can take the bull by the horns, or you can sit around and wallow. What do you want to do? So I said he was very good. He was on my level.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what does that mean? He goes, well, you're wallowing.
Right.
Or you could do something about it. And I got mad at him. He's like, that's okay. You can be mad at me. You can use me as the impetus to get it going. Mm. And then once I started to do it, he's like, you did it for you, not for me.
I like this guy. You got his number?
Yeah.
I want to give it to some friends or maybe even me. He's in New York probably.
He was in Philadelphia. He was tough.
But I want to go back and touch on the writing because we talk about that as a tool. And I like how you said why. It was back to something we said earlier in the show that we got to feel to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've been taught from friends like my buddy Brandon Parkhurst, who does this radical aliveness and core energetic stuff, is that that stuff just stays in us.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, sure, beating on a cube is one thing, and it certainly can be important. But to actually give it a voice, a sentence, a word, an action, you know what I mean? Is very powerful and cathartic to get it out. Not just I'm mad, but what are you mad about? Get it out. It's almost like that child is stuck inside of us in that emotional state, frozen in time, deep down inside. And until we give that child a voice, and I've done it recently just in my room, meditating, processing ex-girlfriends. And you hear what that little child says. It's powerful.
He had me write it with a crayon, like I was a five-year-old.
Whoa.
So he took me back, which was really neat because the first couple letters I did pen. And he's like, you're not there at all. You're just, shut it down and just write. And then when I did it with the crayon, I was there. Because if you write with a crayon, it takes a longer time, than you're flipping through the pen. So I took a longer time to write it, and I had to think. And as I'm thinking, I'm in the moment. Mm. And as I'm in the moment, I'm writing.
Mm.
And then he went through and processed it with me. And that was powerful.
Wow.
But I think, and that's the, that's the combination. You can't just get sober. You've got to do the work.
Got to do the work. Yeah. Abstinence isn't enough. For some people there, I love this quote. I use it all the time. Somebody shared it. The guy said, if you have a drug problem or a drinking problem, you quit, your problems are gone. Mm-hmm. If you're an alcoholic like me or somebody with deeper issues, when you quit, you're stuck with the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So if when you quit, if you're listening at home or try to quit or try to stop, if you don't like how you feel, that's a good signal that you got some deeper work to do. I had a family member who had a bad coke problem. He quit, and he's like, spot on, great. Everything's hunky-dory. That was never my my story. Was like, I feel weird, man. It's been 2 weeks. I deserve to smoke a little speed. I did my laundry. I mopped the floor. Cool. Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. That's good stuff. Let me see. How long is our other song? 420. I don't know. Do we want to sneak it in? Because I want to have time to talk to you about what you have going on now. You got your book that just came out. Was it today?
No, it came out about a month ago.
About a month ago. But you had another book. Oh, you were part of another book that was the Amazon?
I have a workbook on Amazon that's a bestseller.
That's what I was talking about.
And then, so it's for recovery coaching. It's like it's 45 exercises that people can do themselves or a coach can give their client. On how to go through some of this stuff without processing it, but actually doing the accountability work. So action-based planning, circle of influence, timeline, things that'll put you in the here and now in the moment, and then going forward. So it's a little bit different.
That's cool. And what's it called?
Recovery Coach Workbook.
Recovery Coach Workbook. Very cool. And so this one, which is called I Married a Junkie, with a nice picture of you kissing your dude on there.
That was our engagement shot.
Aw. Happy times. Now, you're both sober there?
Yeah.
In that picture?
Yep.
It says, put to the ultimate test by addiction, love, and life. You were telling me when you came in here that he relapsed.
Yeah, when I met him, he was an uppers guy. So he would occasionally dabble here and there with cocaine, but was never out of control. And we were great together. And then one day, I realized he was doing heroin. He flatlined. And he got Narcan.
Whoa.
And I didn't
know.
Where
was
he? In the hospital.
Where was he doing heroin, though?
He met a guy that had blues.
What are those?
Oxys.
Oh, okay.
And he said to the guy, I don't do downers. I'm an uppers guy. And he goes, you got any coke? And the guy said, no. And he goes, well, I don't want that. And he says, try one. So he took one normally, and he said, this is stupid. I don't do pills. I'm not a pill guy. And he goes, snort it. And the guy said, why? And he goes, just do it. And he was hooked.
Oh.
Instantly. And I mean, we talk about it now, and I said, you know, I always thought you were an uppers guy. And he said, I did too until I did heroin. He goes, heroin's my drug. Mm. And I'm like, wow. But he ended up, he flatlined, he got Narcan 3 times. So he, even though
he went from that to shooting?
No, he never shot. He was a snorter.
He flatlined on oxys?
Flatlined on heroin.
On heroin.
Oh, he went from oxys to heroin.
How did he flatline on heroin without shooting it?
Fentanyl.
Oh, fentanyl.
Yeah.
So this is kind of recent.
This is in the past 4 years.
Because seems like the fentanyl started kicking up over the last couple of years. But I've been sober, so I haven't been in the scene, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But
it's been around, I'd say, six where we are. It's been pretty bad. Mm. But he, the first flat line.
And you, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you just got a call. I'm in the hospital. I died.
No. I got a call. I got our BMW stolen. I think I got carjacked. And I said, where are you? And he goes, I'm not sure. He goes, I got bumped in the rear and I got out to look at the damage and they jumped in the car and took off. And I'm going, where are you? And he goes, I'm not quite sure. And I'm like, well, look around. What signs do you see? And then he told me, and I got there, and he didn't have any shoes on. He didn't have his wallet, but he had a cell phone. And I'm like, who gets out of their car with their cell phone and no shoes? Like, it didn't make any sense. Yeah. And I'm like, this doesn't make sense. And he's, like, trying to convince me, and I'm looking at him, and I'm like, something's wrong. Like, it just wasn't right.
And how long had you been together at this point?
4 years.
4 years. You know each other pretty good.
Yeah, but see, I was building my company, so I was never home. Mm. I was always traveling. So
he was lonely.
Yeah.
She rolls her eyes.
Ugh. So that's sort of what started me going, something's wrong. But he was never a downers guy. So I'm going, it's not cocaine. It's not pills. What are you doing? And he would say, nothing. I'm not doing anything. And then there were times where he was totally normal.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure it out.
Couldn't figure it out.
At all.
And you had some experience. You know, that's one of my, you know, we all have pet peeves. And maybe there's something disturbed in me I got to look at. But this thing of drug of choice, I just don't like it. And I deal a lot when we do rock recovery music sessions in treatment centers. And like, you know, my drug of choice is this. I don't like booze. It's like, I feel, and I could be wrong, that at least 90% of those people, you put them on a desert island, and all they have is booze, they're going to turn into drinkers. Or an alcoholic that if they're stuck on an island and all there was pills or coke or whatever, they're going to, because we can't live life sober. You know, I know there are exceptions, but I just don't like it when people think, I've heard it too many times.
I'll agree with you that that's my husband. He is like that. If you put him in a room and there was nothing else, he'll use whatever's in there, but not me. I don't like downers. I'm allergic to morphine.
Yeah, well, you also stopped when you knew you were going to die.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between you and I, because I don't know. I just feel like me and some of my friends, I was like, I don't care. I really didn't care. Mm-hmm. I was like, good, I'm going to get as little as I want to get. And if I die, cool, because it'll just go fast. I was really okay with that. I hope my mom's not listening. She's probably shedding a tear right now. But I really didn't care. Anyhow, so we're back to the story here. How are we doing on time, Ernesto? 10 or 15 minutes. What? Cool. So he has no shoes, cell phone. You're telling the story is a little weird.
something was weird, and I couldn't put my finger on it. So I said, do you want to take a drug test? So he pulled the...
He didn't go, screw you.
No, he went, I'm your husband. Why would you ask me to take a drug test? Isn't that weird? I'm not one of your patients.
Yeah, that's a good angle to take. That's true.
And then I went, is he being manipulative or is it true? And I'm like, well, that's kind of true. So I let it go.
Well, you're essentially saying you're lying.
Right.
Or you got roofied.
Right.
Right.
So I let it go. And then in the mail came a hospital bill. And I said, okay. And then in the mail came an ambulance bill. And I said, what's going on? And he said, I don't know what that's from. That's not me. Someone stole my identity. And I'm looking at him going, now you're full of it. No one stole your identity. He's like, my license is missing. And he opened his wallet. His license was missing. And I'm like,
okay, that's good.
Yeah. Okay. And then he said, I had my license and my ID in the BMW and my Social Security card. And I'm like, why would you have your Social Security card in the BMW? Didn't make any sense. And he's like, well, I was going to get my passport. He always had an answer that made sense. And I'm like, well, that makes sense.
Right when you think you got a corner.
I'm like,
I got this.
So I'm like, you know what? You have to take a drug test. And he goes, fine, I'll take a drug test. So I give him the cuff. Of course, he can't go. I'm staring at him. I'm making him uncomfortable. And it's
your husband.
You've
seen it all by now.
Oh, but then it was, see what you're doing to me? You know, manipulation.
Right, right.
And I said to him, I can tell something's wrong. I don't know what it is, but something's wrong. And he's like, well, you know, I'm not your patient. I'm not your client. You're not going to therapize me. He goes to therapize. He's therapizing me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was like, okay, fine. So I ended up going to Vegas for work. I had a private client. I was gone for 2 weeks. I came back, and every piece of musical equipment he owned was gone.
Oh, no.
That's when I knew. And he's a drummer.
Weren't his eyes pinned?
No. His eyes, the only thing that happened was his right
pupils.
Eye, his eyes would turn pure blue, and then his right eye would shift when he was really high.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, something's up.
Yeah.
So when that happened, I was like, that's it, drug test, I don't care, divorce me, you're going to take a drug test. And that's when he failed the drug test. And I'm like, what's going on? And he just looked at me, and he goes, I have a problem. I'm like, okay, that's a start. What's the problem? Well, I have a small problem. Like, you got rid of all your two drum sets? You have two drum sets? We had Dope's drum set. It's gone. I'm like, where is it?
Well, they don't get top dollar for those things.
No, but it's just gone. So it's like, where's stuff, you know? So that prompted me to start getting him help because I was like, I can't do this.
Did he open all the way up? Because when I had...
No.
Really? He still was only giving up part of it.
So he got a therapist, he got a coach, and he was doing great. And then his father died. And he's daddy's little boy.
Yeah.
And it was unexpected. His father literally went to the hospital and 3 weeks later was dead.
Mm.
And none of us saw it coming. And I went, this is going to be, because he had a year under his belt. I'm like, this is going to be a mess.
Was he totally sober or just off
Totally sober off of everything.
Okay.
Doing good, doing his thing. And I went, And then I got a call for a private client in LA. And I'm like, now what? So I'm like,
so you didn't feel good about leaving?
So I took everything he had and I locked it up in the trailer.
Yeah.
Took the key. He busted that
lock in
2 seconds. It was gone. And he went on his mama at this point. Well, I just, what else to do?
Right.
You know, and he had a coach and he had a therapist and he had a sober companion. And I'm like, what else am I going to do?
Was he out playing music?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I sent a babysitter, but there's only so much I can do. You know, if he's not ready.
Right.
I can't. And I came back and it was a disaster. And that's when I said to him, I'm filing for divorce. I'm done.
That's what you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
You got to give him repercussions.
And I had the paperwork and I set it down in front of him and I said, you made your choice. You're married to heroin.
I should say you got to give us repercussions. Yeah, yeah. And you said you're married to heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
You picked that over me.
Yeah.
And I'm done. I'm not going to fight.
And then.
Here you go. And he called a friend of his and he says, I'm going to take a couple days and just get my head straight. I said, whatever you want to do, go. And he went with a friend of his who's sober, who was a heroin addict.
Oh, that's good.
And
that's a big deal.
He detoxed. Old school. And he came back and he's like, I'm going to go on methadone. And he tried methadone.
Ugh.
And he came back. He's like, this isn't working. He goes,
nope.
This is a joke. And he goes, I've just got to come off. He's, I just got to be clean. And I'm like, okay, what do you need? He's like, I'm just going to do it.
Man
just
up. That's what he did.
He just
did.
Stopped.
Wow.
That's
incredible. That is
so
incredible.
Go ahead.
How long did that whole run of his drugging go? Three or 4 years?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Because he would get sobriety.
Right.
He would get 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And then it was like, bam. And he would go right back on.
So this is a cool, you know, little subplot here, which is that you, with your expertise, didn't think he was an alcoholic or a drug addict to that level. Like,
correct.
Right. But, you know, and actually I was talking to my old bass player. I wasn't either for a while. And then we crossed that line.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something. Who knows? You could say, yeah, it was his dad dying or he found this drug. But whatever. It's different for everyone. But at some point we crossed that line. And once we get across, there's no turning back. And you can't go back to like when, hey, I could just go back to drinking and smoking weed. That's what I tried to do. It didn't work.
Well, here it got interesting. He doesn't like alcohol at all now. He can't drink at all. Hmm. He'll have two sips of something and say, this is disgusting. I don't want it.
Oh, he's lucky. If I have two sips, just goodbye. Goodbye, life.
But now he went and got his tooth pulled, and they offered him Vicodin. He says, I can't do it.
Right,
because I'll do one Vicodin. He goes, and I'm in Dilaudid, I'm in Oxy, I'm in heroin, and that's it. He goes, I can't do it. He can't do any downers. Nothing.
That's insane. I got to digest that story. So he was just totally high. They Narcanned him. He was dead. He didn't tell you.
I had no idea.
Oh, man.
And the thing
is. The things we do.
He's such a good manipulator. He's a good addict. He's a good addict. And he knew what my buttons were because of my dad. So he would say things like, don't you trust me?
Right.
I understand all these men hurt you, but I'm not. You know, and right. I'm like, of course, he'd put me in that position. And it would drop me for a second.
Love can really cloud things, can't it? It can make things very...
But he didn't stop until he was ready. He said that to me. He's like, it didn't matter anymore what was going on. He goes, I didn't care. I didn't care if I lived. I didn't care if I died. Similar to you. He goes, I had to decide I was done.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad he did. And so this book, I Married a Junkie, is the story.
It's the whole story, yeah.
In detail. That's cool. Congratulations on writing it. It is not easy to write a book, and I appreciate you sharing it.
Thank
How
you.
Is Tim going to feel about it?
He loves it.
He loves it. Yeah. You know why? Because he's a musician.
Yeah,
we
I'm
love to be out there.
I'm using it to help people because he feels good because
swear.
He's helping people.
Band guys would take a poop in public and be okay with it if people would watch them.
The stuff they do.
you guys. Yeah. Ernesto, where are we in time? I'm so lost because we started late. Five-ish minutes? All right, so we don't have time for that last song. We don't have time. So tell me, what do you do now? You're a PhD. You're in recovery. Your hubby's in recovery. Tell me the daily battles you're fighting in terms of the good fight. What do you do?
I work with clients. I do private clients. So I do a lot of musicians, actors, actresses, CEOs. I travel. I have a signature product called Sober on Demand where I bring the treatment concept to them, where it's one-on-one wherever. And I'm very busy with that. We're about to go on a book tour with this. He's very excited to go out and do that as well. And he's still in a band. He still plays.
You guys are going to book tour together?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cute.
Oh, why not?
I mean, it's kind of like he, you know, you're the good guy, he's the bad guy in the book anyhow. You know what
I mean? Yes and no. I mean, my upbringing was so horrible, and his was picture perfect.
Mm.
So his story is like nice, 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 and then boom, the bottom drops out. And I'm like messy, 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 and then got my act together.
You know, I'm glad that he chose you. I don't know. There's some joke about that, like, you know, hey, it's either the drugs or me, and you say bye, right? You know what I mean? I had a girl I was very in love with, and I didn't realize it until much later. Because we were talking about this earlier in the show. You could take an incident, and when you're sick and review it, you might go, that person screwed me over. Mm-hmm. And you get a little time, and you go, oh, it wasn't really that. I had a part in it. And then you go a little farther and review the same incident with just your new perception. You have love in your heart. You have recovery. And then you really see, wow, that person didn't screw me over at all. Maybe. I'm just making this up, right? But I just had this whole revelation with this girl and how, like, the drugs made me run away from her. And when I broke up with her, I went on a 9-day bender because that was my day. Like, I didn't sleep one wink in 9 days because I couldn't confront that I was making a bad decision and it was painful leaving a girl that I loved so much. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad for you and Tim that you guys pulled it off and you're together. Now you're going to go on the book tour and share the story and help some people.
That's the goal. Yeah.
That's cool. And then you're doing what? You're going on TV tomorrow?
I'll be on KTLA at 10:30.
Are you going to see Casey Montoya?
I have no idea who I'm going to
see. She's a homie.
Is she?
Yeah, they put Rock to Recovery on there.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, they put... I got to go on there.
Very nice.
Talk about our concert. Are you going to come out to our concert?
When is it?
Saturday, September 15th.
I'll be there.
You better. It's in Los Angeles, so you need another airplane
that's
flight.
Fine. I have so many frequent flyer miles. I can come out here.
Yeah. That's cool. That's awesome. All right. And what else you got going on?
We have a training school for people that want to learn how to be recovery coaches or interventionists, counselors. We have 40 classes, 20 teachers. We're in 22 countries and 5 languages.
Dang. And who started that?
Me.
Wow.
Why not?
You get stuff done.
See, I'm the overachiever, remember?
I think we hear about that a lot, and it's a good message to send. You know, when I think a lot of people, when I walked into rooms, recovery rooms, programs and such, I'd be like, these losers. You know, my brain's like, a bunch of losers. And then you find out, you know, oh, that guy's a stunt pilot? What? Oh, and we start learning about our friends and how after they get sober, they start doing incredible stuff. I got the corn gig because I was sober.
Mm-hmm.
Much better gig than head PE.
And
do
you
incredible
remember
stuff
more of it than Motley Crue, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I didn't, on Motley Crue tour, I peed off the back of the stage onto a light box.
Oh, that's
I used
nice
to get really nervous before we played.
Did
and
you ruin the light box? Did I turn all the lights off and you couldn't play or something?
Well, they had Bob Dallas with them, and I guess I was a silhouette, and he thought I was wearing a beanie, which I wasn't. That's what got me off. He's like, I saw some guy with a beanie peeing on the light box. I was like, wow, that's horrible. And I was like, oh, my God, that was me. But I would get so nervous. They'd go, oh, you guys are on. I'd be like, oh, my gosh, I got to pee. Stage fright. It's a horrible thing. Anyhow, Callie, great show, and thanks for all the work you do.
Yeah, thanks helping for having me on.
This is cool. Because I got to learn a lot about you. You have an incredible story, and you've turned all... I mean, you had a heck of an upbringing, and here you are just helping so many people. Just working it. That's what we get to do in recovery, isn't it?
It is.
It
sure
is.
Very rewarding.
Yeah, yeah. So what would you say to somebody out there struggling?
Find what works for you. Not everybody's method to recovery is the same.
Mm.
So just because your neighbor used... whatever it is doesn't mean that works for you. So you've got to keep searching till you find the thing. People give up. They go, well, I tried what Becky tried, and it didn't work. It's the same thing with diets. People
right
say, oh, I went on the same diet as Becky, and she lost 20 pounds, and I didn't lose any, so I'm never going to diet again. Well, it just means you weren't on the right diet. You have to find that thing that you feel works and then use it.
And then use it. I love it. And then we'll tie it into something I like to say at the end. It's like, we got to not be terminally unique. There's somebody that had your exact problem. They had it worse or they had it less. They had less money, more abuse, less abuse, and recovered.
Mm-hmm.
There's no excuse not to recover in the sense that somebody just like you has done it. So don't give up, right?
Exactly.
And we got to remember we're worth it. If you're listening at home, you're worth recovery. You're an amazing human, divine being that can find the light. So don't give up. So thanks, Dr. Callie Estes. Check out the book, I Married a Monkey. All right. I Married a Junkie.
Thanks, Wes.
Yeah, you're welcome. I am your host, Wes Geer, on Rock to Recovery Radio, brought to you by KX93.5 FM and New Vista Behavioral Health. We're out.